A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it opens with a scene I can picture perfectly because it's Jerusalem. A nun in full habit, standing in line at the post office, picking up an AliExpress package. Just like anyone else, waiting for a shipment of phone cases, or kitchen gadgets or whatever. And Daniel says this moment made his week. Not because it was scandalous, but because it punctured a whole set of assumptions about what monastic life actually looks like.
The folk assumption is that someone who commits to a cloistered order has basically left the world behind. No internet, no shopping, no bars, no contact. Total hermetic separation. And then you're standing in the post office queue, and a woman in a habit is picking up a package from a Chinese e-commerce platform, and you think, wait, what?
Daniel's not just gawking at the incongruity. He's asking the real question. His friend Marcus became friends with a Franciscan friar from Brazil who would occasionally come out for beers at a local bar they all liked. And Daniel's point is, this guy wasn't pressured into being a friar. He chose it. He's deeply committed. And he's also having a beer at the bar. So what's actually going on here?
That's the tension. We assume total withdrawal, but what we actually see is something more like selective engagement. Monastics aren't rejecting modernity wholesale. They're curating their relationship with it. And the question Daniel's really asking is, how does that work in practice? What are the rules? What's the framework?
I think there's a deeper question underneath that, which is, if people who have taken vows of poverty and detachment are still figuring out how to use smartphones and shop online and sit in bars, what does that tell the rest of us, who have made no such vows but still feel overwhelmed by all of it?
That's the episode. Not look at the funny nuns on Amazon. But here's a community that has spent centuries thinking about attention, desire, and detachment, now facing the same dopamine-driven economy the rest of us are drowning in. What have they figured out that we haven't?
Let's start with the rules. Because that nun at the post office isn't there by accident, she's operating inside a whole institutional framework that governs when and how she engages with the outside world. And it's more specific and more interesting than no smartphones.
That framework has a name, or at least a concept. In monastic studies, they call it selective withdrawal. It's not a binary in the world or out of it, it's a spectrum, and different orders sit at different points along it.
The nun at the post office and the friar at the bar aren't anomalies. They're data points on a curve.
Take the Carmelites. Nuns in that order typically leave the enclosure only for medical appointments or essential errands. Their whole charism is built around separation and contemplative prayer. Then, at the other end, you've got the Franciscans, mendicants, which means their vocation actually requires them to be among people. The Brazilian friar Daniel mentioned? Him having a beer at a local bar isn't a loophole. It's the job.
That's a useful distinction. Mendicant versus cloistered. One is called to withdrawal. The other is called to presence.
And most of the major orders fall somewhere between those poles. Benedictines are stable. They stay in one monastery, but they run schools and guest houses. Dominicans are preachers. Jesuits are practically embedded in secular institutions. So when we talk about monastic life as one thing, we're already getting it wrong. The rules governing a Carmelite nun's contact with the outside world are completely different from what governs a Franciscan friar's Friday night.
Which means the technology question isn't one question. It's a different question for each order. A cloistered nun might have zero personal internet access, but still depend on a sister who handles online orders for the community. A Dominican might have a smartphone because his ministry requires it.
This is where it gets genuinely interesting for the tech-interested listener. Because what these orders have developed, mostly without writing treatises about it, is an implicit technology theology. A set of principles for answering the question, when should we engage with this tool, and when should we refuse it?
Not, is this tool good or evil? That's the wrong question. The monastic question is, does this tool serve our charism, or does it distract from it?
That's it. And that's a question almost nobody in secular life ever asks about their phone. Nobody sits down and says, I need a rule of life for this device. I need to decide, in advance, what I'm going to let it do to my attention.
Because we don't have a charism. We don't have a stated purpose against which to measure our tools.
A Carmelite knows her purpose is contemplative prayer. So any technology that fragments her attention is a direct threat to her vocation. A Franciscan knows his purpose is ministry among the people. So a technology that helps him connect might actually serve his vocation. Same tool, different calculus.
This is why Daniel's post office moment matters beyond the novelty of it. That nun wasn't just grabbing a package. She was enacting a decision that had already been made somewhere. By her superior, by her community's constitution, by centuries of accumulated wisdom about what a cloistered life requires and what it can accommodate.
The thing is, they've been thinking about attention management for 1500 years. The custody of the eyes. That's straight out of the rule of St. Sep. It's a discipline about controlling what you look at because what you look at shapes what you desire, and what you desire shapes what you become. Benedict was writing in the 6th century, but he basically described the attention economy.
Before there was an economy for it.
Before there was an economy. And now these communities are adapting that ancient discipline to screens, not by saying, never look, by saying, know why you're looking and look at the right time, in the right place, for the right reason.
The episode isn't really about nuns on AliExpress. It's about what happens when the world's oldest attention management tradition collides with the world's most sophisticated attention extraction machine.
Whether the rest of us, who have neither the tradition nor the vows, can borrow anything from people who have both. Let me give you the numbers, because they're surprising. There was a study in the Journal of Monastic Studies in 2023. Researchers surveyed monasteries across Europe and North America, and they found that 78% have a formal written policy on internet use. Not informal customs. Not the abbot kind of frowns on it.
78% is shockingly high. I would have guessed maybe half that.
The policies are specific. The most common model is what they call designated device, designated place, designated time. Internet access happens on shared computers in common areas, a library, a community room, never in private cells, and only during certain hours of the day. You want to check email? It's between 4 and 5 in the afternoon on the community terminal, and you're done when the bell rings.
It's not no internet. It's internet has a room and a schedule.
And that's the thing most outsiders miss. The monastic approach to technology isn't prohibition, it's architecture. They're designing the physical and temporal space around the tool so the tool doesn't colonize everything else.
Which is basically the opposite of how the rest of us live. Our tools have no room and no schedule. They're in our pockets at dinner, in our bedrooms at midnight, buzzing during conversations.
The monastic instinct is, that's not a technology problem, that's a placement problem. Put the device somewhere, give it a time slot, and it stops being a constant gravitational pull on your attention.
The custody of the eyes becomes a physical layout. You can't scroll at 2 in the morning if the computer is in a locked room downstairs.
And some orders go further. The Carthusians. They're the most austere of the contemplative orders. They have no internet in the monastery at all. But they still need to function in the modern world, so one monk, the procurator, handles all external communication. He has an email account, he orders supplies, he deals with the bank. Everyone else is shielded.
That's the point person model. The community appoints one member to be the membrane.
That's actually the medieval template. Benedictine monasteries have always had a porter. The monk who answers the door, receives guests, handles correspondence. The role is ancient. The technology is new, but the function is the same. One person manages the boundary so everyone else can stay focused on the community's actual work.
Which means the cloistered nun who never touches a keyboard is still, indirectly, on AliExpress, through the sister who does the ordering. Daniel's nun at the post office might be the procurator for her community.
And that's worth sitting with for a second. Even the most withdrawn communities still need light bulbs and toothpaste and, apparently, whatever ships in a padded envelope from Shenzhen. Running a monastery in the 21st century means bank accounts, tax filings, property management, supply chains. You can't opt out of the economy.
Which is why the vow of poverty doesn't mean no money ever. It means no personal ownership. The community owns things collectively, and the procurator spends community money on community needs. The nun picking up the package isn't violating her vows. She's fulfilling them by handling a practical task so her sisters don't have to.
That distinction, personal versus communal, runs through everything. Some orders allow personal smartphones with restrictions. No social media apps, no games, no browser. Basically a phone that calls and texts and maybe has a calendar. Other orders reject personal devices entirely and issue a shared community phone that lives in the common room.
If your family needs to reach you, they call the community phone, and whoever answers passes along the message.
And the reasoning is consistent with the whole tradition. A personal device in your cell is a portal to a private world. Private conversations, private browsing, private desires. That's exactly what monastic life is designed to dissolve. The community phone keeps communication communal.
Which must create real tension for younger monastics who grew up with smartphones before entering the order.
And that's one of the things the 78% figure hints at. These policies aren't static. Communities are constantly revisiting them because the technology keeps changing and the formation directors keep getting novices who've never known a world without Instagram.
The rule isn't just handed down from St. Benedict and frozen in amber. It's a living negotiation.
Different communities land in different places. The Benedictines at St. John's in Minnesota, they run a university and a liturgical press. The monks there have email accounts, but they use a shared computer lab. No personal laptops and cells. The work requires connectivity, so connectivity exists, but it's architecturally contained.
Which brings us back to the spectrum. A Benedictine scholar monk at St. John's has more tech access than a Carmelite nun in Jerusalem, but less than a Dominican preacher who needs a smartphone for ministry. And all of them have more intentionality about it than your average person checking Twitter in bed.
The intentionality is the through line. Whether it's a strict prohibition, or a scheduled window, or a shared device, the common thread is that someone has actually asked the question, what is this tool doing to our life together?
Written down the answer.
Written down the answer, which is more than most of us have ever done.
The rules exist, but rules are one thing. How they actually shape someone's inner relationship with consumption and attention, that's where it gets personal. And I think that's what Daniel was really responding to in the post office. Not just the policy framework, but the psychology of it. Here's someone who has taken a vow of poverty, standing in line for a package from the world's largest bazaar of cheap goods. What's happening inside that decision?
That's the question that hooked me, because AliExpress is basically dopamine in website form. Infinite scroll, algorithmic recommendations, flash deals with countdown timers, customers who bought this also bought. The whole architecture is designed to manufacture desire in real time, and this nun is engaging with it, but in a way that's completely different from how the platform expects to be engaged with.
She's not browsing, she's executing.
And that's the concept I keep coming back to, intentional friction. Monastics deliberately place barriers between themselves and consumption. The nun isn't scrolling AliExpress on her phone in the cloister at midnight. She's making a specific, planned purchase, almost certainly for the community. Liturgical supplies, maybe. Practical goods that aren't easily available locally in Jerusalem. AliExpress ships to Israel, and plenty of residents use it for exactly that reason. Items you just can't find in the local shops.
The transaction happens, but the browsing, the part where desire gets manufactured, that's been stripped out.
Contrast that with how the rest of us shop. One-click ordering. Same-day delivery, algorithmic recommendations that know what you want before you do. The entire secular economy is built on removing friction. Every barrier between impulse and purchase has been engineered away. The monastic approach forces a question that most of us never ask. Do I actually need this, or is this desire being manufactured in me by a recommendation engine?
It's almost like they built a consumer immune system. The purchase still happens, but only after passing through a filter that screens out the impulse.
That filter isn't just personal willpower. It's structural. The shared device in the common room, the designated internet hours, the superior who has to approve purchases above a certain amount, the community that witnesses what you're doing. All of that is friction, and all of it is intentional.
Which makes me think about the newer phenomenon that's been emerging, what some are calling the digital desert movement. Younger monastics, especially in France and Italy, who are reviving the eremitic tradition, but with a very contemporary twist.
This is fascinating. These are people in their 20s and 30s entering orders that emphasize solitude and contemplation. But they're not Luddites. They use technology for work. Translation, remote counseling, digital archives. Some of them are quite technically skilled. But they observe strict digital Sabbaths and internet fasts that can last weeks. The technology is there, but it's been put in a cage.
A cage with a timer.
And the Bose monastic community in Italy is probably the best known example of this thoughtful integration. They run a popular YouTube channel, Chant, Liturgy, Reflections. But they limit production to two brothers who rotate the duty, and here's the detail I love, no monk watches the comments. The content goes out, but the feedback loop is severed.
That's counterintuitive for anyone who's ever run a YouTube channel. The comments are where the engagement happens. That's the whole point of the platform.
They've decided that engagement is precisely the problem. The comments section is a attention vortex. It pulls you into arguments, into vanity, into checking back every 10 minutes to see if anyone liked what you said, so they just don't. The video exists. People watch it. The algorithm does whatever the algorithm does. And the monks move on with their day.
That's a level of discipline around platform design that most social media managers would find incomprehensible.
It brings us back to Daniel's friend Marcus and the Brazilian Franciscan at the bar. Because that's the same principle applied to physical space instead of digital space. A friar drinking beer in a local bar, to a secular observer, that looks like a loophole. Like he's found a way to be a monk while still enjoying normal life.
That's getting it exactly backwards.
The Franciscan charism is mendicant. They're called to be among the people. That's not an exception to the rule. That is the rule. The discipline isn't avoidance. It's intentional presence. The friar is at the bar, but he's not getting drunk. He's not scrolling his phone. He's not flirting. He's present in a way that most bar patrons are not. He's there, fully, with the people he's called to serve.
Which is arguably harder than staying in the cloister.
It's easy to avoid temptation by avoiding the world. It's much harder to sit in the middle of the world and maintain interior detachment. That's the whole spiritual challenge of the mendicant life.
The Brazilian friar having a beer isn't a contradiction of his vows. It's an expression of them. He's practicing a different kind of custody of the eyes, not by looking away, but by looking differently.
That connects directly to what I think the audience can actually take from all of this. The monastic model offers a framework for selective connectivity that doesn't require total withdrawal. The key insight isn't, monks are just like us. It's that monks have rules that make their technology choices deliberate, and we have none.
We outsource our attention architecture to the platforms themselves. They design the environment, and we just live in it.
A Benedictine monastery designs its own attention environment. The internet has a room and a schedule. The phone has a purpose. The purchase has a justification. None of this requires vows, but all of it requires the one thing monastics have, and we mostly don't, a prior decision about what our life is actually for.
Let's make this practical. If someone listening wants to borrow that intentionality without taking vows, where do they start?
I'd say start with the custody of the eyes. It's the most portable piece of the whole tradition. The principle isn't never look, it's know why you're looking. And you can operationalize that tomorrow by designating specific times and places where screens are allowed, and specific times and places where they're not.
Which is basically what the Benedictines do with the computer lab. You're building a room and a schedule for your attention.
And it doesn't have to be elaborate. No phone in the bedroom is a custody of the eyes rule. No screens at the dinner table is a custody of the eyes rule. You're not rejecting the device. You're giving it a boundary so it stops bleeding into every corner of your life.
The phone lives in the kitchen after 9 p.m. That's a monastic move, whether you call it that or not.
The second piece is what I keep calling intentional friction, but applied to purchasing. The nun at the post office didn't impulse buy. The purchase passed through community approval, a designated device, a scheduled internet window. Most of us have none of that scaffolding, so the simplest version is a 24-hour waiting period. Before you buy anything online, you wait a day.
Which sounds trivial until you actually try it.
It's brutal. Because the whole architecture of online shopping is designed to collapse the gap between desire and purchase. The countdown timer. The only three left in stock. The discount that expires at midnight. Waiting 24 hours breaks that spell. And the question you ask in that waiting period is the monastic question. Is this a need? Or is this desire being manufactured in me by a recommendation engine?
You don't need a spiritual director to answer that. You just need to notice that after 24 hours, half the things in your cart feel completely unnecessary.
The friction does the work. You don't have to be a monk to recognize that a flash sale at 2 a.m. is not a coincidence.
The third thing, and this might be the one that actually sticks, is writing something down. A personal technology rule of life. Even 3 bullet points.
Monastics have constitutions. Whole documents that govern how the community lives together. You can have a constitution for your relationship with your devices. And I'm not talking about a 40-page rulebook. I mean 3 sentences you write on a note card and tape to your desk.
No phone in the bedroom. No social media before 10 a.m. One screen at a time.
That's it. That's a rule of life. And the act of writing it down matters because it moves the decision from the moment of temptation to a moment of clarity. You're not deciding whether to check Instagram at 7 a.m. when you're half awake and the phone is in your hand. You already decided yesterday when you were thinking clearly.
That's the whole monastic insight about rules, isn't it? They're not restrictions you impose on yourself in the moment. They're decisions you made in advance when you were actually capable of making them.
The rule protects you from yourself. From the version of you that's tired, or bored, or lonely, or just reflexively reaching for a dopamine hit. The monk doesn't negotiate with temptation at the monastery gate. The gate was already built.
The goal here isn't to become a monk. Nobody's suggesting you need a habit and a cloister.
The goal is to borrow their intentionality. In a world where the most valuable resource is your attention, and the most sophisticated engineering on the planet is devoted to capturing it, the most radical thing you can do is decide, deliberately, in advance, where you're going to place it.
That's the through line. Whether it's a Carmelite nun who never touches a browser, or a Franciscan friar having a beer at the bar, or someone listening to this podcast who just wants to stop checking their phone during dinner, the common thread is a prior decision. A line drawn before the moment of temptation arrives.
The beauty of it is, you don't need a vow of poverty to draw that line. You just need to admit that the default settings aren't working.
Then write down 3 things. Here's where we land. That nun at the post office. She's not a symbol of contradiction. She's not a holy person failing to be holy because she ordered something from a Chinese warehouse. She's a symbol of discernment. She's in the world, but not of it. And that's a harder, more interesting position than total withdrawal.
Total withdrawal is clean. You draw a line and you stay behind it. Selective engagement is messy. You have to keep asking the question, every purchase, every device, every trip to the post office. Is this serving what I'm actually here to do?
That question never goes away. You don't answer it once and coast. The technology changes. The community's needs change. The available tools change. The nun who picked up that package might have a completely different relationship with AliExpress in 5 years, because her superior revised the policy, or because the platform changed how it works, or because the community decided the friction wasn't enough.
Which is why the written policy matters so much. 78% of monasteries have one, and they're revisiting it constantly. That's not bureaucracy. That's a community taking its own attention seriously enough to govern it together.
That's the invitation, I think. Not to adopt a specific rule. No phones in the bedroom, 24-hour waiting periods, whatever. But to adopt the posture. The willingness to ask the question in the first place. What is this device actually doing to my life? And what would change if I decided in advance where the boundary goes?
Here's the open question we want to leave with people. What would your life look like if you treated every notification, every purchase, every scroll as a choice rather than a reflex?
Not a sin, not a failure.
Just a choice.
Something you could say yes to or no to, instead of something that just happens to you while you're not paying attention.
Because that's what the monastic tradition offers, underneath all the rules and the schedules and the community computers. It's not a technology policy. It's the assumption that your attention belongs to you, and you get to decide where it goes.
You don't need a cloister to believe that.
This has been My Weird Props. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping the show running. If you enjoyed this episode, do us a favor. Rate and review the show wherever you're listening, and visit myweirdprompts.com for every episode in the archive.
Next time, we're digging into something Daniel sent us about diplomatic language. What it actually means when a meeting is described as working level, and why governments have entire vocabularies for saying things without saying them. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
Cantonese has 6 distinct tones, while Hokkien has 7 or 8, depending on the dialect, making Hokkien one of the most tonally complex Chinese languages still spoken today.
Right.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.